for a significant tax deduction. Turn your property into something meaningful. Visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 844-277-4663 to learn more.
Hi, this is Shepard Ferry, and you're listening to People Powered Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. I'm about to
have a nervous breakdown. This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
I'm Margo Okasawa-Ray. So today, my guest is Dr. Sister Alexis Pauline Gumpz, who describes herself as queer, Black troublemaker, and Black feminist love evangelist. I love it. And an aspirational cousin to all sentient beings. Alexis is an independent scholar, author. She's a prolific writer of books, poems, essays, and more. Alexis and their beloved Sangha Dore also creates and facilitate regularly spaces for education, emotional and spiritual renewal, and transformation. A tall order. She is the author of Undrowned, Black Feminist Lessons from Marine Mammals, and I definitely want to hear something about that book. And she also won the Zora, formerly known as the Hurst and Wright Legacy Award, and the Judy Grand Prize in lesbian nonfiction for the wonderful Survival is a Promise, The Eternal Life of Audre Lorde.
All right, I'm so happy to be with you, Margot.
Thank you so much for being here today. Welcome, Alexis. You have been my, in a way, a North Star, you know, on matters that are deep and beyond the analytical. I want to just catch up with you and hear what's at the deepest parts of who you are that inspires you to do the kinds of writing and activism and bringing people together that you're doing now. Can you just share with us, who are you? I mean, which planet did you fall from? you know, your ideas, your heart, everything about you is so beyond this plane and at the same time rooted in this plane, rooted on planet Earth. So talk to us.
Oh, well, what a beautiful way for you to contextualize me. You are my North Star. I see myself as an emanation made possible by the dreams and actions of generations of Black feminists, even before the words Black feminist were words. And there is something really core for me in that intervention, which you yourself were a part of, with the Combahee River Collective statement, with what we would call the foundation of Black feminist movement in the 1970s and 80s, who insisted that everything is interconnected. And so that interconnection, you know, at the time, was you all giving yourselves and everyone else permission to look at systems of oppression as interlocking and to claim all aspects of who you are and who you were. And for me, it has given me permission to understand that we're connected to all life forms we can get Black feminist lessons from marine mammals and from
I want to hear about that.
And from the cosmos. So that interconnectivity, which is love, and which I have seen you, people of your generation and people of all generations, demonstrate as this dedication, commitment, and love, and refusal to be separate from who we are, our inherent dignity as life, is why I'm here. And I sometimes it surprises me when I'm like, oh yeah, that's connected too. Oh yeah, you know, our ancestors are not only of one species, they're of all forms. And our history and our movement is old, even older than the languages that we currently know. So I'm grateful that I get to live an expansive Black feminist life because of the bravery and innovation and love and insistence and persistence of Black feminists like you.
Well, thank you very much. And I expect to see you in my next lifetime in whatever forms we appear.
I promise. So, yeah.
Good. You know, let's start by you just telling us a little bit about your own development to what you just expressed so beautifully, really body, mind, spirit, you know, and beyond, I guess. So how did you get to where you are? You write and you post a lot about your dad, especially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for asking. Right now, as you mentioned, my partner Sean Godari and I have launched this curriculum that, or our version of a curriculum that my dad created called the Chrysalis Life Purpose Roadmap. And both of my parents were people who grew up inside of striving West Indian families. They grew up with a lot of social messages about who they should be, what they should do. And then in the middle of their lives, as many people, they were like, wait a minute, what am I doing here? Who am I? Who really am I? You know, what is really possible? And so my parents raised me and my siblings with this curiosity of like, well, who are you? You know, like we're not going to impose on you, this is what you should do and this is what it must be. They really were curious about who we were and at the same time interested in us having resources. Like I have this book on my desk, the books that I was seeing when I was growing up. This is Angela Y. Davis, a photo of her on this anthology that she co-edited with Bettina Apthaker while she was in prison or in jail, the Marin County Jail, if they come in the morning. And so having revolutionary writing by Black women surrounding me as I grew up is a very key part of why I am who I am, why it's sacred and important to me to understand that Black feminism is my context, it's my ethic, it's my spiritual practice, it's my political commitment, it's my proof that love is more powerful than everything. And this life purpose roadmap thing is basically, you know, my dad metabolized what other people would call his midlife crisis into a set of questions that can have us think about, like, why are we here? And what is our commitment beyond our own lifetimes? And so it's been incredible because my dad is an ancestor. October will be 10 years since he passed away, to be able to be engaging our community in this type of way. And in fact, if you want to participate, we are going to be having a new cohort. We'll start in September. We're in a cohort now. You can't join the cohort that already started, but in September, if you go to mobilehomecoming.org, you can see more and come join us in this ongoing practice. Because that's one of the things that I learned from watching my parents change their lives, is that purpose is an ongoing question. And we get to be in that question for our entire lives.
And it changes, you know, over time, although there may be a core theme that cuts across your lifetime, right? The particulars and the ways that it's manifested may differ. And I love this beginning, Alexis, because as you said, you know, love kind of carries everything, and it really does. And we're not talking about the cheesy Hollywood. It's a deep, you know, it's a deep, deep, deep thing that you're talking about, processes. So, you know, you were inspired by your dad. You spoke about your ancestors and, you know, generations before you doing the work. Right. What was the turning point for you that said, okay, this is the direction I want to be a writer?
I started writing praise poems to my family members. Those are the first things I remember writing. I was trying to describe the people in my family who are beyond description, like all people are, right? People are infinitely complex. You can never describe a person fully in a poem or in any other type of writing, but I wanted to reflect them back to themselves. And I honestly think that's still what I do, like to this very day. But there was a way that when people received a poem, in this case, like from a child, just reflecting them back to themselves, they valued it and they accepted it as something like this is important. Like this is an important role for somebody to play, to witness us, to reflect us back to ourselves, to bring us out of the everyday into this like place where we can like ring, ring in our dignity, especially as people who in systems of oppression are not always recognized in our dignity
So
in
there's
the
the
everyday.
reflection, and it's not reflection like just looking into a mirror, right? It's sometimes just to see what you look, make sure you look good or look proper or something, but you're talking about a different kind of mirror, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? What is the mirror doing actually as it's reflecting?
I think that what happens when we have, I think in particular, a multi-generational reflection and mirror, we're able to see, again, like I was saying in the beginning, what we're connected to, right? That we're not isolated and just alone out here as an individual persona reflecting like this is what I look like, this is how I show up. We're connected to generations, we're connected to everything around us, we're connected to species, we're connected vibrationally, and poetry and poetic language, because I think everything I do is poetry, but sometimes it gets categorized and wins award as nonfiction, as you said
You're
earlier.
right. Whiting, the Whiting Award.
It's all a poetic process of resonating us back to ourselves. So we can see possibility there, so we can understand ourselves in a greater context. I remember I wrote a poem and I was comparing my uncle's voice to like the sound of thunder. And there was something about that elemental connection that is different than like you just a loud black man, you know what I mean? Like however that sound
Right.
might have been, but to say like there's something like of this earth, and transformative and grand about the sound of a particular person's voice, that sound for me in the orchestra of what listening to the adults in my family gave me. And I do think there's something about the intergenerational too, where you see how a child sees you, or you can see how your elders see you, that also expands our being, where we then can realize like, oh, there's impact. Oh, there's legacy. Oh, there are patterns. There are patterns I might want to continue and honor, and there are patterns I might want to shift, right? That there's a way that, I often say the universe is a poet, and sometimes we can see, or sometimes as the artist, we can show those patterns, and they in that awareness, they make something else possible.
So your mirror connects, it contextualizes. And it acknowledges and transforms. That's the kind of mirror you're talking about. And did I get it?
Yes, I love that. That's it.
Okay, so it's not what grandma told you to stay away from, as Sweet Honey in the Rock
Right. It's
sing about.
not the no mirrors in my grandma's house beating you
Right.
up and face self-criticism, because mirrors have been tools, right? In so many different indigenous cultures, and I learn more and more that reflection is actually something that's for our spiritual growth and not for the kind of surface level vanity that, Sweet Honey and the grandmothers that inspire that song are telling us is not as important as what art shows us, which is what is inside.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow, that's really brilliant. So the next thing I want to talk about, and at the end, please, I want you to give out the information for the fall for the fall session, and we'll put that in our website too. So the next thing is you have written a lot. Books. I also understand you were described as somebody who does playwriting.
Secretly, but yeah. I also have been a dramaturg for Sharon Bridgeforth, which has been a great honor.
Right. So it's you're transdisciplinary, right? You go across all these categories of writing. The start of a new book, writing a new book, what's the catalyst? You know, what helps you choose what's the topic, you know, et cetera? Like, that's another kind of a catalyst question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, sometimes I don't know that I'm writing a book. You know, usually, so as you said, I write a lot. That's because writing is a core daily practice of mine. Every single day. It's writing is how I am who I am. It's how I receive my guidance. It's how I ground into life. So there's not a day that I don't write. And usually there's something that my soul is seeking that I might not even know how to describe yet, but I at least can find a practice. Like that's how Undrowned, mm-hmm. What became Undrowned, Black Feminist Lessons from Marine Mammals. I was just listening to whale songs. The current issue, the summer issue of Orion magazine has this essay I wrote in it called Blue Whale Radio, which tracks some of that. And you can see it on Orion's website because it was the Keystone article, but the issue itself is beautiful and it's all about whales. Anyway, so, you know, I was in my grief. I was trying to figure out how do I hold and express these feelings. I was listening to the marine mammals and I was like, you know what? Maybe I need to listen to the marine mammals. You know, maybe that there's something that marine mammals can teach me. Not thinking I'm writing this as a book like that other people are going to read, Margo, but just that this is something that I need for myself, right? For my transformation, like you said, for my reflection, for my understanding of my connection. I just needed to go there. And I'm a repetitive person. So it was like every single day I'm writing about a different marine mammal. What could they teach me? And then there came a point, and I remember it because it was the day before Mother's Day, and I was writing about how the hooded seal gets everything they need from their mother in only 3 days, and then they just like go out across the planet. And I was like, 2 days? And it's
3 days?
This like fat. And I might be like now saying it wrong, but it's like a short amount of time. And then they just go. But the nutrients that they get in that time sustain them. And then, you know, they have what they need. And I was like, you know what? I think that some of us, you know, I at the time, you know, my mom moved to England. And that's the furthest away that I have been from her. And then we had COVID and we couldn't be with the people. And there's all sorts of other distance that people have from their mothers, whether it's because of conflict or whether it's just because of distance or because they passed away or, you know, whatever that is. And I was like, I think maybe other people need to know that even if they have incredible distance from their parents, they can possibly still have what they need already to do what they need to do and to go where they need to go. And so I just shared it on Facebook. And then it was like, oh, no, I'm supposed to share these. And now I understand that I'm supposed to share these. And then it was other people who were like, girl, we can't just be scrolling through. Like, well, you need to put these in a book. You know? Toshi Regan was one of the people who was like, where's the book? You know, and Adrienne Marie Brown, who ultimately published the book in her imprint, AK Press, was like, we need this to be able to hold this and reflect and look at these. Which is to say, it's not for me like, oh, I have this great idea. Let me make it into a book. for me, it's something that organically comes out of my practice. Mm-hmm. And then I can understand, oh, where is the place there? Sometimes, and not always, sometimes some of my practices, y'all don't even know anything about because this is just for me. But some of them, I realize, oh, this belongs to a community in a particular way. This is part of my responsibility to community. And so then I'm responsible for curating it in a way that community can receive and then take it and have their own reflection and, you know, do the things that they'll do with it. And people do amazing things. Like out in the Bay Area, there is the Bushwick Book Collective. A group of songwriters, they're all making songs based on Undrowned, Black Feminist Lessons from Marine Mammals, because that's the reflection they found. And that's the art form that they use. And when they told me that was happening, I was like, what? You know, and I never imagined that that would be. But there have been so many things like that. And I think that I do think that my writing continues to be mirror work in the way that you describe, because people see. They relate to it. They resonate. I think they do see themselves, but they see something that's possible, and often they do something, which is really exciting to me.
Totally. And, you know, I'm thinking that what you just described from my perspective as a feminist is, you know, the best kind of theorizing, right, comes from experience. Right. And what I just heard you saying is, you know, you're just kind of going along in your life. Something happens, you know, in this case, learning, you know, seeing that you could learn something from beings other than human beings or in addition to human beings. So you go to these mammals in the sea creatures, right? Mm-hmm. You learn from them, you think about the people, you know, whose lives you're connected to, you take those lessons, put it in different languages where folks you're committed to, whose lives you're committed to, really understand on multiple levels, right? And, you know, it's like a circle.
Yeah.
And then it goes into practice, right? And you do a different, you know, related kind of practice, right? So what I'm seeing as you're speaking is circles.
Yes. Yes.
The big circles and the little circles between you and the moment that you're facing something in your life.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It is a circle. I mean, and what's incredible is my grandmother, Lydia Gumbs, designed the Revolutionary Anguillian flag, and it's three dolphins swimming in a circle.
Oh.
And so that ended up being like the image for Undrowned, because I was like, this has been with me, right? So these circles, that circular movement is so key. I love the way you said that. And it's the circle of our days, you know, it's our repeated actions, right? It's our practices that end up constituting who we are and what our offering is to the planet and to each other.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just on a whale watch thing out here on Cape Cod.
Of course you were.
And, you know, knowing that those whales, you know, can come from as far away as the Cape of Good Hope. Mm-hmm. Tip of South Africa, right? End of the African continent. They can come up this far, or if you're on the Pacific, you know? And so these travels, you know, literal and figurative, take us a long way. And going back to that seal, 3 days, mm-hmm. full up, you know, ready to go.
Ready to go.
Ready to go. And it also made me think about the social construction of family, mm-hmm. you know, how you have to get everything over the whole lifespan, or at least through your adolescence, right? 18 years or something. And what you just said really pushes that. And I wonder, what's the nutrients the seals get? What would be our equivalent so that mm-hmm. we can, in human time, go out in 3 days?
Right. That concentrated, right? It's like the fattiest milk ever that these seals are giving, you know? And like, what does it, what could we imagine in order to think about our contribution to other people? Because it, I mean, it could be our children. It could be the children in our families and in our lives, but it also could be that, you know, I don't know. We're having this conversation on the radio. I don't know who happens to be listening to this radio thing, who's never going, I hope you all read the books and, you know, find the things and come to the workshop. But, you know, they might not, and they might just be in the car for a second, and they might even hear the end of the show. You know, how much of the love that's flowing through me can I just pack into every moment just in case, right? So that the person listening, they're going to hear the word love, you know, like no matter where they start and where they end this interview, love is going to be there. And I have a commitment, and we all have the possibility of living in that way, right? We're like, if someone spends a moment with us, somewhere in that moment is that core of what we're here to bring. And what if we could be accountable to that? Not in a ridiculous way, like we're never resting and we just always got to be on, or, you know, something like
That's a
that.
whole nother topic, right? Yes.
But just because the sustainable way to do that is like, oh, so to be sure that I'm loving myself, you know, so even if I'm not saying anything, right, that there's that vibration that I'm holding, or somebody might notice me being curious about, like, how do I get back to a space of love, you know, if, which is, you know, in my grief, you know, I was writing Undrowned after my father passed. In my grief, I had this question, like, how do I tune into this way that I'm growing? And I feel like my heart is getting bigger. I feel like every age of me is asking me to attend to different form of grief, because my father was the first person who I lost, who literally every single age of me until that very moment had a relationship to. And I was like, this is so overwhelming. Like, how do I even do this? And I was like, I feel like I'm in an ocean of tears, basically. That's how I felt. And I was like, well, you know who knows how to live in a salt ocean? A whale does,
A
you
whale.
know? And they make it look easy, you know what I'm saying? So I was like, maybe I need to learn something from them, you know? And life often is like, we're in this space where there must be something more. You know, there's clearly something I need to learn, because maybe I feel stuck, or I feel overwhelmed by what I'm going through. And often there's a being. It could be a whale, it could be a seal, it could be, you know, a Black feminist scholar like Margo Okazawa-Rae, who has produced not only her amazing books, but now this consistent radio program where we get to learn lessons. You know, there's so much there, and we
And
get to
teachers come in different forms,
yes.
right? As different beings, different experiences. We are in conversation with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gums, talking about life, love, and transformation. We'll be right back.
Freedom, when she call my name.
Hi, everyone. I know you've heard our fundraisers and likely thought, yeah, I should likely give something back to KPFK. Well, now's the time to do it. We all understand the value of separating luxuries from necessities and deciding what's truly essential. KPFK is one of those essentials. We provide in-depth, cutting-edge, intelligent coverage, and it starts with our amazing staff and volunteer programmers and with your financial support. Contributions from our listeners add up to the largest share of funding that pays the bills here at KPFK. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, encouraging you to become a KPFK Sustainers Circle member now. A sustaining contribution of just $20 or more a month is one of the most popular levels for our donors, and it takes just minutes to contribute. Just go to kpfk.org/support, then click Sustainer Circle, or call 818-985-2711. Thank you so much for your donation to KPFK, radio powered by the people.
Wilgear Theatricum Botanicum returns this June 6th through October 4th with outdoor repertory theater, events, and educational programs for all ages. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, alongside Romeo and Juliet, Treasure Island, Noel Coward's Waiting in the Wings, and Bernardo Cubría's dark and incisive new comedy, The People of Pompeii, set in the aftermath of the 2025 Palisades fire. Theatricum is located in Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway, in the shade of the California live oaks. Explore and picnic in the gardens before the show. Further information available at www.theatricum.com and at kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
Freedom, when she call my name. Oh, I wonder if she call again. Call again and I'll answer. Oh yeah, call again and I'll answer. I don't think we've met before. Heard some old folks talking about you like you was the Lord. Call again and I'll answer. Oh yeah, call again and I'll answer.
As most of our listeners know, that was Liz Wright singing Toshi Reagan's music. What a combination.
Yes, such a powerful combination.
Okay. So anyway, let's get back to our wonderful conversation. I'm learning so much. We are in conversation with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gumbs, talking about life, love, and transformation. So let's start with one of your most recent works, which is the biography of our beloved ancestor, who's with us all the time, actually, and not just here in the U.S. You did a wonderful biography of her. Can you please tell us, what was that like? You know, first of all, what inspired you, and how did you go about it? How did you know what to write? In other words,
oh, what a great question. So I guess this comes out of practice too, just a long practice. You know, I learned about Audre Lorde when I was 14 years old, and I started to read her poetry, and I started to quote her poems as epigraphs to every single thing I wrote when I was in high school. It would be either her, or it would be James Baldwin, but it was usually Audre Lorde. And I stayed with that, you know, I kept staying with that. And I had the, you know, I wrote about Kitchen Table Press for my thesis in college. And I wrote about Audre Lorde, June Jordan, Alexis DeVoe, and Barbara Smith for my dissertation. And I had the opportunity to be the first person to visit Audre Lorde's papers, which are archived at Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia. Everyone should visit. Wonderful archivist Holly Smith, who's there, is the best. And when I was first in those archives, I didn't know that I was going to write a biography. What I knew was that I needed to bring the lessons that I was seeing about poetry, about publishing, about politics, about teaching. So to turn it to pedagogy, I needed to bring it home to my community. I started doing a School of Our Lord, like a night school in my living room in the duplex where I lived, where I was like making games, because we talked about the intergenerational mirror. So it'd be like whole families, you know, like little babies, grandparents, like everybody in the room. And I'd be like, okay, let's play this game, you know, the quality of light. You know, Audre Lorde writes about the quality of light, and we're just turning the light switch on and off. We're doing all sorts of stuff. So so all that is to say, it was years and years and years and years, and got to go to St. Croix and assist Dr. Gloria Joseph when she was creating the Wind is Spirit bioanthology that she created for Audre Lorde, and had all of these, like, met so many people who knew Audre Lorde and who carried that energy and told me stories. And then what happened was I couldn't ignore it anymore, because Alexis DeVoe, who wrote Warrior Poet, the first biography of Audre Lorde, was publicly complaining. Why hasn't anybody else written a biography of Audre Lorde? Where's the next biography of Audre Lorde? And she would complain this right in front of me. And I'd be like, yeah, somebody should, right?
Yeah, that was a hint, big hint.
I was missing the hint, you know? Then one day she said this, and she was in our kitchen. It was Shango Dari's 40th birthday revival, and Sharon Bridgeforth was asking her about writing Warrior Poet, and she was like, and I don't understand why nobody else. And everybody in the room was looking at me, and I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to do this.
Hello.
Why was I the last one to know? But then it was the next day that the person who's now my literary agent called and was like, you know, it seems like it's really time for another biography of Audre Lorde. And I've been calling around and I've been asking Black feminists, like, who should write this? And they all keep saying Alexis Pauline Gums. And she didn't know who I was. She was like, whoever that is. So it was like the universe aligned. I feel like it was, and I don't know what the universe is a poet. And obviously Audre Lorde is a poet. How has she got 20 years, two poets named Alexis, both writing biographies of her. You know what I'm saying? Like,
hey, it's meant to be, clearly.
Ancestral power.
Right. So, you know, as you were learning about her life and learning lots of things that most of us probably will never know, was there anything in particular that jumped out at you that helped you understand her commitments and also who she is, just the ordinary person living her life?
Yeah. I mean, well, beautiful thing is that she really kept journals, and she kept her journals from when she was a kid.
Wow.
Which like really opens this, you know, where she's like complaining about like having to walk the dog. It's, you know, like the things that are mundane, and we don't think, like, we think about this grand person, you know, those of us, especially people like me, who are of a generation where I didn't get to meet Audre Lorde and see her just being a person, right? I met her through these poems that are just mystical and incredible and very earth-based and, but also grand. And I was like, oh yeah, this is a person, you know, this is a person who would write and talk about, you know, maybe they weren't smart enough to be the editor of their literary magazine because they picked someone else. Or none of us, would any of us for a second think Audre Lorde couldn't be the editor of the literary, you know? But as a teenager, she felt insecure like so many other people feel insecure, right? Even in her 40s, when she's talking about, why does she procrastinate about her writing when she knows that's why she's here on the planet? Why is she looking for another dish to wash and another chore to do in the house? And it's relatable because we're all, like I was saying right before the break, you know, we're all asking that question about what allows us to tune back in to our power and to that love. And that, to me, is the thing about Audre Lorde, that she was persistent in that way. She would then find it. She would then say, well, you know what? I think I'm going to have to write about these cosmologies in West Africa to figure out how do I understand my life beyond my lifetime when I'm faced with my mortality of cancer, right? Or I think I need to move to a majority Black island, you know, if I'm going to live in the way, you know, she would ask herself that question and she would find the answer. And then she would very often share it with everyone, right? As an example, not because she thought people should be exactly like her, but because she wanted people to always remember that they had the power to change their lives and to speak the truth that they were scared to speak, first of all, to themselves. Why is it a scary truth? Because it means I'm going to have to change my life,
yeah.
Right?
Right. And
I want to live in a world where we all remember that we have that power.
Mm-hmm. And I want to just, you know, pick up on something about what you just said, which is she spent, you know, some years in Berlin getting the treatment she needed, you know, before she went to an all Black island, right?
Right.
So Berlin kind of is pretty white. Just the opposite, right?
Situation.
Berlin is pretty white at the time. And now there's still a very vibrant Black feminist community.
Yeah.
And some of them were featured in the film, Audre Lorde, The Berlin Years.
Yes. And Heidi R. Lewis, the great, also created a book called Walking in Audre's Footsteps. And I'm going to Berlin next week to be with them. And it's an incredible, and you were mentioning your friend, and you've been making connections with that community too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the point I want to make here is that wherever she went, she reflected. She was a mirror. So those Black women in Germany, for the first time, as they described it in that documentary, saw themselves in each other through Audre and through each other's eyes.
Yes, yes, which is a beautiful thing. And it was the love, right? I mean, Ika Hugel described, like, Audre Lorde, she picked Audre Lorde up at the airport, meeting her for the first time, and Audre runs over and hugs her and is like, oh, Ika, it's wonderful. She's like, how'd she even recognize me?
Right.
One, there probably weren't that many Black people in the airport, but two, Audre had looked at the conference that they had and studied the pictures of the women. She just was like preparing herself to love these women, and they could feel it. And they talked about the contrast of feeling not recognized as Black women in Germany over and over again every day, people looking at them like they shouldn't even be in this country.
Right.
And Audre is just like, before she even meets them, so in love, you know, and excited and pouring forth this energy.
And that curiosity, you know, who will I be meeting? You know, it gets reflected back as love.
Yeah.
You know, it exudes as love. I'm so jealous you're going. You're going to have a great time.
your ears are going to be burning because we're going to be singing your names.
So you have another book that's co-written, right? That's coming out in the fall.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's not co-written, but it's inspired by Alma Thomas.
Yes. Talk to us about who that is.
Listen,
and why this book. Come on.
Why this? Well, once again, I'm just trying to live my life, right? So so I went to DC. I had a wonderful art date with Joan E. Byron, who you know, the legendary lesbian feminist photographer. I think people listening to this show, maybe you do know, but if you don't yet, two of her incredible books are recently back into print. And it's just, speaking of a mirror, right? Speaking of reflecting community back. So I'm with Jeb and she's like, you got to go see the Alma Thomas exhibit at the Phillips Gallery. That's our hometown hero. This is one of our DC great, great painters. And I was like, oh, okay. Come to find out the exhibit had already left. And I was like, dang it. Because I don't, you know, I love a homework assignment, Margo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're a nerd. Once a nerd, always a nerd.
Once a nerd, always a nerd. I'm like, I got to complete my assignment, but the exhibit's gone. So then I went to Tennessee. The exhibit was there. So I was like, okay, Sean Godard, we got to go. this incredible retrospective of Alma Thomas called Everything is Beautiful. And whoa, I was like, no wonder Jeb told me to need to learn about this person. Alma Thomas, Black woman born in 1891 outside Columbus, Georgia. You know, Margo, that we have the historical periodization. 1891 is the height of lynching, right? Here she is in rural Georgia. And I was like, what happened? Like, you asked me, how did I become who I am? I'm like, how did this person, like, literally living on the color line, right? Lynch mobs, her mom running from a lynch mob when she's pregnant with her, you know, like this is the reality, becomes this color theorist, like the influential painter changing the way people see color itself. And the first Black woman to have a solo show at the Whitney Museum, and taught in segregated DC public schools for over 30 years, and created the first art gallery in the DC public schools, and devoted her life to create this beauty club. She was devoted to the creativity of Black children, mm-hmm. and for them to be able to have a self-defined relationship with beauty. And wow. I was like, this is so revolutionary.
Totally. And why haven't most of us heard of her?
Exactly. So now you see what's about to happen.
Yes, right? Please.
So, but first, you know, I'm always going to, like, this is one of my teachers. I'm now realizing this is one of my teachers. Mm-hmm. Like, she's teaching something that I need to learn. Of course, I made a practice. Every single day I'm writing a poem in response to one of her, or really inspired and following the energy of one of her paintings or her photos and her archival materials, which are all digitized by the Smithsonian, by the way, so everyone can look at them. And I was just like, I was taken on a journey. I was taken on a journey, and I was like, oh, this is important. And then I was like, oh, well, you know, I ended up collecting the poems, and I was like, yeah, I think that, like you said, more people need to know about mm-hmm. Alma Thomas. And then I started to look at, like, well, what have people said about Alma Thomas? And, you know, there were too many instances where I heard Alma Thomas described as an apolitical artist. And I was like, well, that's confusing to me, because what's apolitical about devoting your life to the creativity of Black children and transforming the meaning of color and even being an abstract painter, you know what I'm saying, coming from 1891. So I was like, yeah, that's not going to stand. So that then became, so there's essays in the book, because I was like, I think people have gotten it twisted. And Alma Thomas herself said, you know, I'm cited for my color paintings, which, you know, in an art market that doesn't want to think about politics and doesn't want to think about racial transformation or the revolutionary creativity of Black women, pretending like something's apolitical maybe is convenient in that arena. But what Alma Thomas said is, she said, I'm cited for my color paintings, but I would want to be remembered for my impact on the lives of children.
Oh, that's so humble.
And I was like, you know what? Whatever I can do so that is how she's remembered, that is what I must do. So the book is called Primary. It thinks about Black children, especially actually Alma Thomas's younger sisters, as the primary audience for her creative practice. And it's poems and it's essays, and it's coming out from Yale University Press. It comes out September 29th. And I'm so excited about it, because I think it's an opportunity for, I mean, there was a time where if you walked through the Shaw neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and you walked by three people, at least one of them had been Alma Thomas's art student.
Oh, interesting. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. And I know that neighborhood. Yeah.
And this is an opportunity for those of us who were not around in the Shaw neighborhood, or even alive, or, you know, whatever it is, to be her students too, and to have a relationship to vibrancy, power, this idea of beauty that, again, right, like we were saying before, is not like vanity type beauty, but like what she understood was that there was energy. Like when she was making a painting, mm-hmm. and when she was supporting Black students and Black children to make their art, she was saying, this is you. You get to then control the energy.
Yeah.
You get to bring that energy and make it something that's visible and tangible.
Another example of mirror, mm-hmm. of mirroring, you described, you know, I want to know more about her. I hope you listeners, will also pay attention to the opening of the book. I don't know if that's the right word. Let's open the book. Maybe I can have you back on the show and talk more about that. So for now, though, can you read us just some section that will give us a hint of what the book is about and most important, who Amma Thomas was?
Oh, yes. Okay, I'm pulling it up right now.
So her students were at the turn of into the 20th century, early 20th century.
Yeah, by the time she was teaching, so she was born in 1891, mm-hmm. moved to DC as a child. By the time she's teaching, it would then have been like the teens, 20s.
20s, yeah, right.
30s, and then she continued. And by the time she had that exhibit at the Whitney, she was, they called her an old new artist because she was 76 years old.
And think of all the other Black women and other, you know, marginalized, quotes, people, right, mm-hmm. who are heroes in the ways that you just described her, who are beings kind of beyond our comprehension, even looking back.
Exactly.
Every day, the everydayness of what you're saying is so profound, right? And because it was every day, makes it even more profound.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. My goodness, what do I say? Well, here, I'll just read this little part. Maybe that speaks about.
Okay, I'm in conversation with the wonderful Alexis Pauline Gumbs, who I kind of put her on the spot by asking to read something at the last minute. She's looking for it. She has an upcoming book that will be released in September, and we hope that everybody will find it. It's called Primary. The title is Primary, and it's about artists most of us know nothing about. Alma Thomas, who was born in 1891 and taught in D.C. Black schools in the early 20th century. Can you imagine?
Okay, I'm going to read this part, which is before she was born. Rose Hill, Georgia, 1891. Every breath a prayer. Amelia Thomas was shaking. Would that she could be as rooted as a poplar, but she had to be ready to run. Big with her first child, she prayed that the men with dogs and ropes would pass by, disperse, give up, go away. Eventually, the Georgia trees received her anxious prayers, breathed in her carbon dioxide pleas, and used them to whisper their own wonderings. What tree would the mob choose next? Which of their limbs would be desecrated by the cruel white supremacist enforcement of man's inhumanity to man? Amelia survived that night in Rose Hill. But when she gave her soul to light, birthed Alma, her first child, and sang to soothe her brown baby's dreams, she noticed that her daughter was born hard of hearing. Her fear, Amelia believed, transmitted through amniotic fluid, had blocked her baby's listening ears. Even before she was born, Alma had heard too much. I'll stop there.
I think we just need to take a breath. I need to take a breath. Mm-hmm. You know, we went in this conversation from Wales, from your dad to your Wales, to Audre Lorde, to the women in Germany, now to Alma Thomas, that who takes us all the way back to the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And the continuity, and you describe yourself as connected to all sentient beings, and I think the conversation today demonstrated that. You mm-hmm. gave us such a view of the connectedness of generations and of us, in this case, to whales or dolphins, right? Mm-hmm. I just need to take a breath. That was stunning.
Mm. Thank you, Marco.
And before our time runs out, I'd like also to bring into our conversation your beloved.
Yes.
Ah, you're smiling. I can hear you.
People can't see I'm beaming every time anybody mentions Shango Dare. I'm just so in love.
So what's the relationship have to do with the work?
So I believe that our ancestors schemed to bring us together to achieve our highest destiny, which is to bring Black feminist love into all its next life forms, along with that, with our beloved community. And Shango Dare is so, so creative, so innovative, so believes in the power of community that she just pushes me to be braver than I am. You know, I'm the one that wants to sit inside and write a poem every day about something, you know, but Shango Dare is like, our whole community can transform. And Shango Dare is really the reason that this chrysalis project that, you know, that my dad created, like why we're putting it out into the world. Shango Dare produced series of videos so people can do it at a self-paced level. And it's incredible to be in this, like you said, what love is, right? Love is transformative. And it is such a gift to be in this transformative process with Shango Dare. It feels like an adventure. It's been 17 years that we've been in this journey together, and it is
almost your whole adult life, I guess.
Yes. So we've lived through different decades of our lives together. You know, we met in our 20s, now we're in our 40s, and yeah, so, and I think Shango Dare's mom's listening to this radio broadcast right now too. So I'm blushing. Hi, Mama Ann.
Hello. I hope to meet you one day. And yes. Anyway, it's not just Shango Dare's mommy. What's her name?
Antoinette Wallace.
All right. Welcome.
Antoinette Wallace the Great. Yes.
Well, I think we're almost out of time, unfortunately. Okay. I'm going to have you come back after your book launch mm-hmm. and talk more about the book and continue this wonderful conversation. Thank Yay. You so much, Alexis Pauline
Thank
Gumbs.
Thank you, Margo. Oh, and people can mobilehomecoming.org.
Yes. mobilehomecoming.org. Mobilehomecoming.org. Thank Yay. You so much, Alexis Pauline Gumbs.
She call my name. Oh, I wonder if she call again. Call again and I'll answer.
You're invited to tune in to The QR Code with your hosts, Ramses Ja and Q Ward.
The Q in the QR code goes by the name of Q Ward.
The voice you just heard is the R in the QR code. He goes by the name Ramses Ja.
Every Monday through Thursday at 6 a.m.
Be sure to join us next time as we share our news with our voice from our perspective. And until then,
peace.
Support for people-powered KPFK comes from a historic night of music taking place Wednesday, October 28th,
Join us at the historic Alex Theater in Glendale for Stanley Clarke and Friends, presenting a special concert celebrating 50 years of the landmark album School Days. Serving as the evening's music director, five-time Grammy Award-winning bassist Stanley Clarke leads an extraordinary cross-genre lineup of iconic artists coming together to support KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. Newly confirmed to join this incredible night are David Bowie pianist Mike Garson, alongside acclaimed singer, musician, and member of the celebrated vocal group The Hayden Triplets, Petra Hayden. They join an already prestigious roster of special guests, including John Densmore and Robbie Krieger of The Doors, Danny Carey, juggernaut drummer for Tool, Rudy Sarzo, renowned rock bassist, Michelle Coltrane, jazz vocalist, with even more surprise guests still to be announced. Every single dollar raised from this unforgettable evening directly benefits people-powered KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, keeping independent, commercial-free radio alive and thriving. Tickets, VIP reception packages, and complete details are available online at kpfk.org/Stanley. That's kpfk.org/ST.